Chapter 6. A Terrible Discovery. As the weeks went by, John found the time passing very quickly because he was so happy with the Washingtons. July under the shadow of the Diamond Mountain was a month of soft nights and of warm, happy days. John and Kismine were in love. He did not know that she kept the little gold football which he had given her to show his love on a silver chain around her neck, hidden by her dress. But she did. And she did not know that a large jewel, which had dropped one day from her hair, was hidden in John's jewel box. Late one afternoon, when the music room was quiet, they spent an hour there together. He held her hand and whispered her name, and she looked into his eyes. She bent toward him, then hesitated. "Did you say Kismine?" she asked softly. "Or kiss me?" She had wanted to be sure. She thought she might have misunderstood. Neither of them had ever kissed before, but they soon got used to the process. The afternoon drifted away. That night, when a last note of music drifted down from the highest tower, they each lay awake, happily dreaming about the minutes of the day. They had decided to get married as soon as possible. Every day, Mr. Washington and the two young men went hunting or fishing in the deep forests, played golf on the empty course, games which John allowed his host to win, or swam in the coolness of the mountain lake. John found Mr. Washington a difficult person to get along with. He was totally uninterested in any ideas or opinions except his own. Mrs. Washington was silent and distant at all times. She didn't seem to care about her two daughters, but was entirely absorbed in her son, Percy. They would have endless conversations at dinner. Jasmine, the elder daughter, looked like Kismine, except that she had thin legs and large hands and feet, but had a totally different personality. Her favorite books were about poor girls who helped their fathers after their mothers had died. John learned from Kismine that Jasmine had never recovered from the shock and disappointment she had suffered when the World War ended. She had wanted to go to Europe and help with cooking for soldiers, so she was very disappointed when the war ended. She was depressed for a little while, and Braddock Washington helped start a new war in Europe just to please her. But one day she saw a photograph of some wounded soldiers, and she did not like the way they looked, so she lost interest in the subject. But Percy and Kismine seemed to have inherited the arrogant attitude and coldness of their father. Every idea and thought they had was selfish and self-centered, but this did not bother John in the least because they were rich, and he liked all rich people. John was in love with the wonderful palace and valley. Percy told him that Braddock Washington had ordered his men to kidnap a landscape gardener, an architect, a landscape designer, and a French poet. He had told them they could use all his slaves. He promised to supply them with any materials they wanted, and he left them to design his palace and gardens. But they had all been useless. The poet just sat around in depression, complaining that he missed his city and did not contribute at all to the planning. The designer wanted to fill the whole valley with tricks and special effects, an idea that the Washingtons did not like. And the architect and the landscape gardener were unable to come up with any new and original ideas. They were only capable of copying styles that already existed. But unlike the prisoners from the hole on the golf course, they did at least solve the problem of what to do with them. They all went crazy one morning after spending the night in a single room trying to agree upon the location of a tree, and they were now all being held safely at a home for the mentally insane in Westport, Connecticut. "But," inquired John curiously, "who did plan all your wonderful reception rooms and halls and bathrooms?" "Well," answered Percy, "I am embarrassed to tell you, but it was a man who makes movies. He was the only man we found who was used to having an unlimited amount of money to spend, though he did have bad manners, and he couldn't read or write." As August drew to a close, John began to regret that he would have to go back to school soon. He and Kismine had decided to run away together the year after. "It would be nicer to be married here," Kismine confessed, "but of course I could never get father's permission to marry you at all. so we'll have to run away. It's so much trouble for wealthy people to be married in America these days. They always have to send out notices to the press saying that they're going to be married. They always feel that they have to marry someone wealthier than they are.
I know, agreed John. The Schnitzer Murphy's eldest daughter married a man who was poorer than her, but still very wealthy. She wrote home complaining about how hard it was to survive with less money, and then she ended her letter by saying, "It's been hard having only 4 maids, but I'm surviving." Isn't that ridiculous?
Yes, it is, commented Kismine. Think of the millions and millions of people in the world, all the poor workers and farmers who have to live with only 4 maids.
One afternoon late in August, an accidental comment of Kismine's changed the entire situation and put John into a terror. They were sitting in their favorite grove of trees, and, between kisses, John was enjoying talking about his fears for their future. He liked talking about these fears not because he was actually scared, but because he thought talking about these things made their situation seem more dramatic. "Sometimes I think we'll never marry," he said sadly. "You're too wealthy. No one as rich as you are can be like other girls. I should marry the daughter of some wealthy businessman from a normal town and be content with her money."
"I knew the daughter of a businessman once," remarked Kismine. "I don't think you'd have been satisfied with her. She was a friend of my sister's. She visited here."
"Oh, then you've had other guests?" said John, surprised. Kismine seemed to regret her words.
"Oh, yes," she said hurriedly. "We've had a few."
She seemed embarrassed.
"But aren't you... wasn't your father afraid they'd tell other people about your diamond?"
"Oh, maybe," she answered. "Let's talk about something more cheerful." But John was curious now.
"Something more cheerful?" he said. "What's unpleasant about guests? Didn't you like having them here? Weren't they nice girls?"
To his great surprise, Kismine began to cry.
"Yes, that's the whole trouble. I quite liked some of them. So did Jasmine, but she kept inviting them anyway. I couldn't understand why she did it."
A dark thought came to John. "Do you mean that they told people about your diamond and your father had them removed?"
"Worse than that," she muttered. "Father doesn't take chances, but Jasmine kept inviting them to come, and they had such a good time."
She was crying heavily. Shocked with the horror of this, John sat there open-mouthed and shivering.
"Now I've told you, and I shouldn't have," she said, calming down suddenly and drying her dark blue eyes.
"Do you mean that your father had them murdered before they left?" She nodded.
"In August, usually, or early in September, before going back to school. Of course, we wanted to get all the pleasure out of them that we could before they were killed."
"How horrible! Why, I must be going crazy! Did you really admit that—"
"I did," interrupted Kismine, shrugging her shoulders. "We can't really imprison them like those pilots, because it would upset us to have to see them locked up. And Father always made it easier for Jasmine and me by killing them sooner than we expected. That way we never had to say goodbye."
"So you murdered them? Ugh!" exclaimed John.
"It was done very nicely. They were killed while they were asleep. And their families were always told that they got suddenly sick and died."
"But I don't understand why you kept on inviting them," John cried out.
"I didn't," burst out Kismine. "I never invited anyone. Jasmine did. And they always had a very good time. She'd give them the nicest presents at the end, and they were so happy. I will probably have visitors, too. We can't let a small thing like death make us stop enjoying life. Think of how lonely it'd be out here if we never had any guests. Father and Mother have killed some of their best friends, just like we have."
"And so," said John angrily, "and so you were letting me love you and talking about marriage, all the time knowing perfectly well that I'd never get out of here alive?"
No,
she protested passionately.
Not anymore. I did at first. You were here. I couldn't help that. And I thought your last days might as well be pleasant for both of us. But then I fell in love with you and I'm honestly sorry you're going to be put away, even though I'd rather you be put away than ever kiss another girl.
Oh, you would you? Cried John.
Yes, very much. Besides, I've always heard that a girl can have more fun with a man whom she knows she can never marry. Oh, why did I tell you? Now you might not have a good time, and we were really enjoying things when you didn't know it. I knew it would make things sort of depressing for you.
Oh, you did you? John's voice trembled with anger. I've heard enough of this. I don't want to have anything more to do with you. How could you pretend to love someone who you knew was just a corpse?
You're not a corpse, she protested in horror. You're not a corpse. Don't say that I kissed a corpse.
I didn't say that.
You did. You said I kissed a corpse.
I didn't.